Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Nau mai, haere mai. I'm John McDonald. Kia ora and welcome into the Community Drive Hut Zone on Thursday, the 20th of November. The Hut Zone is Wellington Access Radio's weekly look into the stories, people, poems and music that make the Hutt Valley community. Tonight we hear about the latest poetry book from former Eastbourne writer Mary McCallan. It's called Tackling the Hens and published by the Cuba Press. There's another Catherine Mansfield short story reading from In a German Pension, and there's music from two talented Hutt performers, Amelia Lynn on piano and Hutt band Tom Tom and the Groove Daddies, featuring an extremely talented Hutt five-year-old on the drums. So let's start things off with our short story reading of the week, another story in Catherine Mansfield's 1911 book, In a German Pension.
The Modern Soul by Catherine Mansfield. Narrated by Harry Dobby. Good evening, said the Herr Professor, squeezing my hand. Wonderful weather. I have just returned from a party in the wood. I have been making music for them on my trombone. You know, these pine trees provide the most suitable accompaniment for a trombone. They are sighing delicacy against sustained strength, as I remarked once in a lecture on wind instruments in Frankfurt. May I be permitted to sit beside you on this bench, gnädige Frau? He sat down, tugging at a white paper package in the tail pocket of his coat. Cherries, he said, nodding and smiling. There is nothing like cherries for producing free saliva after trombone playing, especially after Grieg's Ich liebe dich. Those sustained blasts on Lieb make my throat as dry as a railway tunnel. Have some? He shook the bag at me. I prefer watching you eat them. Aha! He crossed his legs, sticking the cherry bag between his knees to leave both hands free. Psychologically, I understood your refusal. It is your innate feminine delicacy in preferring etherealized sensations. Or perhaps you do not care to eat the worms. All cherries contain worms. Once I made a very interesting experiment with a colleague of mine at the university. We bit into 4 pounds of the best cherries and did not find one specimen without a worm. But what would you do? As I remarked to him afterwards, dear friend, it amounts to this. If one wishes to satisfy the desires of nature, one must be strong enough to ignore the facts of nature. The conversation is not out of your depth. I have so seldom the time or opportunity to open my heart to a woman that I am apt to forget. I looked at him brightly. See what a fat one! Cried the Herr Professor. That is almost a mouthful in itself. It is beautiful enough to hang from a watch chain. He chewed it up and spat the stone an incredible distance. Over the garden path into the flower bed. He was proud of the feat, I saw it. The quantity of fruit I have eaten on this bench, he sighed. Apricots, peaches and cherries. One day that garden bed will become an orchard grove, and I shall allow you to pick as much as you please without paying me anything. I was grateful without showing undue excitement. Which reminds me, he hit the side of his nose with one finger. The manager of the pension handed me my weekly bill after dinner this evening. It is almost impossible to credit. I do not expect you to believe me. He has charged me extra for a miserable little glass of milk I drink in bed at night to prevent insomnia. Naturally, I did not pay. But the tragedy of the story is this. I cannot expect milk to produce somnolence any longer. My peaceful attitude of mind towards it is completely destroyed. I know I shall throw myself into a fever in attempting to plumb this want of generosity in so wealthy a man as the manager of a pension. Think of me tonight. He ground the empty bag under his heel. Think that the worst is happening to me as your head drops asleep on your pillow. Two ladies came on the front steps of the pension and stood, arm in arm, looking over the garden. The one, old and scraggy, dressed almost entirely in black bead trimming and a satin reticule. The other, young and thin, in a white gown, her yellow hair tastefully garnished with mauve sweet peas. The professor drew in his feet and sat up sharply, pulling down his waistcoat. "The Godowskas," he murmured. "Do you know them? A mother and daughter from Vienna. The mother has an internal complaint, and the daughter is an actress. Fraulein Sonja is a very modern soul. I think you would find her most sympathetic. She is forced to be in attendance on her mother just now. But what a temperament! I have once described her in her autograph album as a tigress with a flower in the hair. Will you excuse me? Perhaps I can persuade them to be introduced to you." I said, "I am going up to my room." But the professor rose and shook a playful finger at me. "Nah," he said. "We are friends, and, therefore, I shall speak quite frankly to you. I think they would consider it a little marked if you immediately retired to the house at their approach, after sitting here alone with me in the twilight. You know this world. Yes, you know it as I do." I shrugged my shoulders, remarking with one eye that while the professor had been talking, the Godowskas had trailed across the lawn towards us. They confronted the Herr Professor as he stood up.
"Good evening," wavered Frau Godowska. "Wonderful weather. It has given me quite a touch of hay fever."
Fräulein Godowska said nothing. She swooped over a rose growing in the embryo orchard, then stretched out her hand with a magnificent gesture to the Herr Professor. He presented me.
"This is my little English friend of whom I have spoken. She is a stranger in our midst. We have been eating cherries together."
"How delightful," sighed Frau Godowska. "My daughter and I have often observed you through the bedroom window, haven't we, Sonja?" Sonja absorbed my outward and visible form with an inward and spiritual glance, then repeated the magnificent gesture for my benefit. The four of us sat on the bench, with that faint air of excitement of passengers established in a railway carriage on the qui vive of a train whistle. Frau Godowska sneezed.
"I wonder if it is hay fever," she remarked,
worrying the satin reticule for her handkerchief.
"Or would it be the dew? Sonja, dear, is the dew falling?"
Fräulein Sonja raised her face to the sky and half closed her eyes.
"No, Mama, my face is quite warm. Oh, look, Herr Professor, there are swallows in flight. Are they like a little flock of Japanese thoughts?
Nicht wahr?"
"Where?" cried the Herr Professor. "Oh, yes, I see by the kitchen chimney. But why do you say Japanese? Could you not compare them with equal veracity to a little flock of German thoughts in flight?"
He rounded on me.
"Have you swallows in England?"
"I believe there are some at certain seasons, but doubtless they have not the same symbolical value for the English. In Germany..."
"I have never been to England," interrupted Fräulein Sonja. "But I have many English acquaintances. They are so cold." She shivered.
"Fish-blooded," snapped Frau Godowska. "Without soul, without heart, without grace. But you cannot equal their dress materials. I spent a week in Brighton 20 years ago, and the travelling cape I bought there is not yet worn out. The one you wrap the hot water bottle in, Sonja. My lamented husband, your father, Sonja, knew a great deal about England. But the more he knew about it, the oftener he remarked to me, "England is merely an island of beef flesh swimming in a Gulf Sea of gravy." Such a brilliant way of putting things. Do you remember, Sonia?
"I forget nothing, Mama," answered Sonia. Said the Herr Professor,
"That is proof of your calling, Gnadinger's Fräulein. Now I wonder, and this is a very interesting speculation, is memory a blessing or, excuse the word, a curse?"
Frau Godowska looked into the distance. Then the corners of her mouth dropped and her skin puckered. She began to shed tears.
"Ah, God! Gracious lady, what have I said?" exclaimed the Herr Professor.
Sonia took her mother's hand.
"Do you know," she said, "tonight is stewed carrots and nut tart for supper. Suppose we go in and take our places."
Her sidelong, tragic stare accusing the professor and me the while. I followed them across the lawn and up the steps. Frau Godowska was murmuring,
"Such a wonderful, beloved man."
With her disengaged hand, Fräulein Sonia was arranging the sweet pea garniture. "A concert for the benefit of afflicted Catholic infants will take place in the salon at 8:30 p.m. Artists, Fräulein Sonia Godowska from Vienna, Herr Professor Windberg and his trombone, Frau Oberlehrer Wiedel, and others." This notice was tied around the neck of the melancholy stag's head in the dining room. It graced him like a red and white dinner bib for days before the event, causing the Herr Professor to bow before it and say, "Good appetite," until we sickened of his pleasantry and left the smiling to be done by the waiter, who was paid to be pleasing to the guests. On the appointed day, the married ladies sailed about the pension dressed like upholstered chairs, and the unmarried ladies like draped muslin dressing table covers. Frau Godowska pinned a rose in the centre of her reticule. Another blossom was tucked in the mazy folds of white anti-massacre thrown across her chest. The gentlemen wore black coats, white silk ties and ferny buttonholes tickling the chin. The floor of the salon was freshly polished, chairs and benches arranged, and a row of little flags strung across the ceiling. They flew and jigged in the draught with all the enthusiasm of family washing. It was arranged that I should sit beside Frau Godowska, and that the Herr Professor and Sonia would join us when their share of the concert was over.
"That will make you feel one of the performers," said the Herr Professor genially. "It is a great pity that the English nation is so unmusical. Never mind, tonight you shall hear something. We have discovered a nest of talent during the rehearsals."
"What do you intend to recite, Fräulein Sonia?" She shook back her hair. "I never know until the last moment. When I come on the stage, I wait for one moment, and then I have the sensation as though something struck me here." She placed her hand upon her collar brooch. "And words come."
"Bend down a moment," whispered her mother. "Sonia, love, your skirt safety pin is showing at the back. Shall I come outside and fasten it properly for you, or will you do it yourself?"
"Oh, Mama, please don't say such things." Sonia flushed and grew very angry. "You know how sensitive I am to the slightest unsympathetic impression at a time like this. I would rather my skirt dropped off my body.
Sonia, my heart!"
A bell tinkled. The waiter came in and opened the piano. In the heated excitement of the moment, he entirely forgot what was fitting and flicked the keys with the grimy table napkin he carried over his arm. The Frau Oberlehrer tripped on the platform, followed by a very young gentleman, who blew his nose twice before he hurled his handkerchief into the bosom of the piano. "Yes, I know you have no love for me, and no forget-me-not, no love, no heart, and no forget-me-not," sang the Frau Oberlehrer, in a voice that seemed to issue from her forgotten thimble and have nothing to do with her.
"Ach, how sweet, how delicate," we cried, clapping her soothingly.
She bowed as though to say, "Yes, isn't it?" and retired, the very young gentleman dodging her train and scowling. The piano was closed, an armchair was placed in the centre of the platform. Fraulein Sonja drifted towards it. A breathless pause. Then, presumably, the winged shaft struck her collar brooch. She implored us not to go into the woods in trained dresses, but rather as lightly draped as possible, and bed with her among the pine needles. Her loud, slightly harsh voice filled the salon. She dropped her arms over the back of the chair, moving her lean hands from the wrists. We were thrilled and silent. The Herr Professor beside me, abnormally serious, his eyes bulging, pulled at his moustache ends. Frau Godowska adopted that peculiarly detached attitude of the proud parent. The only soul who remained untouched by her appeal was the waiter, who leaned idly against the wall of the salon and cleaned his hands with the edge of a programme. He was off duty and intended to show it.
"What did I say?" shouted the Herr Professor under cover of tumultuous applause. "Temperament! There you have it. She is a flame in the heart of a lily. I know I am going to play well. It is my turn now. I am inspired. Fräulein Sonja," as that lady returned to us, pale and draped in a large shawl, "you are my inspiration. Tonight you shall be the soul of my trombone. Wait only."
To right and left of us, people bent over and whispered admiration down Fräulein Sonja's neck. She bowed in the grand style. "I am always successful," she said to me. "You see, when I act, I am." In Vienna, in the plays of Ibsen, we had so many bouquets that the cook had three in the kitchen. But it is difficult here. There is so little magic. Do you not feel it? There is none of that mysterious perfume which floats almost as a visible thing from the souls of the Viennese audiences. My spirit starves for want of that. She leaned forward, chin on hand. "Starves," she repeated. The professor appeared with his trombone, blew into it, held it up to one eye, tucked back his shirt cuffs and wallowed in the soul of Sonja Godowska. Such a sensation did he create that he was recalled to play a Bavarian dance, which he acknowledged was to be taken as a breathing exercise rather than an artistic achievement. Frau Godowska kept time to it with a fan. Followed the very young gentleman, who piped in a tenor voice that he loved somebody, with blood in his heart and a thousand pains. Fräulein Sonja acted a poison scene with the assistance of her mother's pill vial and the armchair replaced by a chaise longue. A young girl scratched a lullaby on a young fiddle. And the Herr Professor performed the last sacrificial rites on the altar of the afflicted children by playing the national anthem. "Now I must put Mama to bed," whispered Fräulein Sonja. "But afterwards I must take a walk. It is imperative that I free my spirit in the open air for a moment. Will you come with me as far as the railway station and back?" "Very well, then. Knock on my door when you're ready." Thus the modern soul and I found ourselves together under the stars. "What a night," she said. "Do you know that poem of Sappho about her hands in the stars? I am curiously sapphic. And this is so remarkable. Not only am I sapphic, I find in all the works of all the greatest writers, especially in their unedited letters, some touch, some sign of myself, some resemblance, some part of myself. Like a thousand reflections of my own hands in a dark mirror."
"But what a bother," said I.
"I do not know what you mean by bother. It is rather the curse of my genius." She paused suddenly, staring at me. "Do you know my tragedy?" she asked. I shook my head. "My tragedy is my mother. Living with her, I live with the coffin of my unborn aspirations. You heard that about the safety pin tonight. It may seem to you a little thing, but it ruined my first three gestures. They were..."
Impaled on a safety pin, I suggested. Yes, exactly that. And when we are in Vienna, I am the victim of moods, you know. I long to do wild, passionate things. And Mama says, please pour out my mixture first. Once, I remember, I flew into a rage and threw a washstand jug out of the window. Do you know what she said? Sonia, it is not so much throwing things out of windows, if only you would... Choose something smaller, I said. No. Tell me about it beforehand. Humiliating. And I do not see any possible light out of this darkness. Why don't you join a touring company and leave your mother in Vienna? What? Leave my poor, little, sick, widowed mother in Vienna? Sooner than that, I would drown myself. I love my mother as I love nobody else in the world. Nobody and nothing. Do you think it is impossible to love one's tragedy? Out of my great sorrows, I make my little songs. That is Hein or myself. Oh, well, that's all right, I said cheerfully. But it is not all right. I suggested we should turn back. We turned. Sometimes I think the solution lies in marriage, said Fraulein Sonia. If I find a simple, peaceful man who adores me and will look after Mama, a man who would be for me a pillow, for genius cannot hope to mate, I shall marry him. You know, the Herr Professor has paid me very marked attentions. Oh, Fraulein Sonia, I said, very pleased with myself. Why not marry him to your mother? We were passing the hairdresser's shop at the moment. Fraulein Sonia clutched my arm. You, she stammered. The cruelty, I am going to faint. Mama to marry again before I marry, the indignity. I am going to faint here and now. I was frightened. You can't, I said, shaking her. Come back to the pension and faint as much as you please, but you can't faint here. All the shops are closed, there is nobody about. Please don't be so foolish. Here and here only. She indicated the exact spot and dropped quite beautifully, lying motionless. Very well, I said. Faint away, but please hurry over it. She did not move. I began to walk home. But each time I looked behind me, I saw the dark form of the modern soul prone before the hairdresser's window. Finally, I ran and rooted out the Herr Professor from his room. Fraulein Sonia has fainted, I said crossly.
Du lieber Gott! Where? How?
Outside the hairdresser's shop in the station road.
Jesus and Maria! Has she no water with her?
He seized his carafe.
Nobody beside her?
Nothing.
Where is my coat? No matter. I shall catch a cold on the chest. Willingly I shall catch one. You are ready to come with me?
No, I said. You can take the waiter.
But she must have a woman. I cannot be so indelicate as to attempt to loosen her stays.
Modern souls oughtn't to wear them, said I. He pushed past me and clattered down the stairs. When I came down to breakfast next morning, there were two places vacant at table. Fraulein Sonia and Herr Professor had gone off for a day's excursion in the woods. I wondered.
I'm John MacDonald, and you're in the Hot Zone on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM, and that was The Modern Soul by Catherine Mansfield, read by Harry Dobby. Thank you to Bookstream Audiobooks for making that reading available. Time for a little Scriabin from Lower Hutt pianist Amelia Lynn. Thank you. That was Scriabin's prelude Opus 11, performed by Amelia Lynn. My next guest has just released a new poetry book, and so I thought we should meet up, hear some poems from the book, and talk about its writing and publishing process. This is part one of a two-part series.
My name's Mary McCallum, and I've written a book called Tackling the Hens.
I like that title because I'm trying to settle in two new hens at the moment, so that could very much relate to that title. Why that title for the new book?
Oh, well, it's one of the poems in the book. And when I had them all collected together, I kept going in different directions. What do I want to be the main theme of the book, or appear to be? Like, obviously, it's quite hard to bring a collection together under one theme. And often people just pluck one poem out and go, that's the one. But I actually wanted something that kind of took you into the collection and kind of gave you an in on a lot of the poems and why they were there and why I wrote them, I guess. So I thought Tackling the Hens did the job, because it's like tackling stuff, the big questions, as well as smaller things in your life. For example, my mother had died not long before we published this, and I was still putting the collection together, and I had some recent poems around that. So that was a big question, and there were smaller things, daily things, stuff that happens to you in there too. But yeah, I felt like the poem's literally about tackling some hens, but I felt the title in itself embraced those other ideas. And in that, writing that poem about these chooks, I realised that in fact it was also about the kind of marvellous chaos of family. You know, it is chaotic, or can be. There's at least disorder underlying a lot of what you're trying to do with a family. And that's what those hens are. And I write a lot about family and the wider group of friends that I'm lucky enough to have in my life. Yeah.
So shall we start with a reading of Tackling the Hens, please?
All right. Thank you. I really do. And what, you know what? I also like the humour in it. And I feel like ultimately that's what I want to come through. Yeah. Okay. Tackling the Hens. Day one. We tackle the hens before it gets dark. Bill's the first. She's in the basket with the lid, preternaturally quiet. We grab George, but when we open the lid to deposit her, Bill takes her chance and scarpers. George is off too, a flurry of wing and complaints. Mildred has disappeared. Bill and George hole up in a huff under the hedge. Bill's giving me the side eye. George's eyes are shut. She appears to be meditating. Mildred shimmies through the gate, claws the grass, looks murderous. Just yesterday, Bill was sunbathing with us, sprawled between our deck chairs like an old and unruly friend. The sort who brings out cigarettes and offers them around, leaves their shoes where you walk, starts cooking meals you don't want to eat. That was before we decided enough was enough and the chickens needed to go back to John next door, the useless chicken coop. Day two. Two of them chuckle past the low, open window. Their combs catch my eye. One pauses to look in, nods at me, inscrutable. Bill, they truck on. Day three. I'm lying on the couch reading, the tiny sounds of claws on tile. For a moment, I think there's a dog in the room again after so long. Oh, how well behaved, how shorn, a room without a dog. I can almost smell the disorder. But it's Mildred, her head beside mine, gimlet eye amused. I shoo her away, but I'm laughing. I think she's laughing too. Day four. We caught them, all three. George, Mildred, Bill. They've been returned to John next door, who promises to clip their wings, sort out the useless coop. Yeah, right. It's quiet here as the sun sets. When we walk, it's just us. Day five. One's back. Must be Mildred, always the first and best escaper. She's outside gossiping. With quick steps, I make my way to the door. So that, I love that they're in the delight, actually really enjoying them, because they're fun if chaotic. And you note, of course, a number of them have men's names, because my husband named them. He has no idea about hens. They may
George
most
Mildred.
Likely be female. There we go.
This is a couple
it
there.
It doesn't really matter. Eh?
How long has it been in the making for this poetry book?
Oh, that's a good point, actually. I mean, my first collection came out in 2018, so that's 7 years. But there are poems in here that I wrote a long, long time ago. So they sort of sat, they didn't fit with the other one, which is a much smaller collection. And I thought, oh, they'd fit here. There are still some I haven't included that, you know, sitting around. So it has to work together. So, yeah, so I guess I haven't consistently worked on it since 2018, probably most consistently have applied myself in the last 2 years. Takes a while, you know, it's a lot of work looking at everything, rethinking them. Yeah.
What is your process of creating a book like that, writing new poems or revisiting old ones?
I guess it's having a good big folder on your Dropbox, which is where I keep everything that the poems go. And I might have a subfolder for stuff that still needs working on, and another folder for work that I feel is more polished. And then at some point you just really go in hard out, you know, and think what are these all doing? Are they all working or not? And of course you change a bit over time and how you write things. So it's really sitting down and making the time to go through them and really address them, because otherwise they're just going to sit there for another 7 years. And I'm lucky enough to have a writing group that I share them with, a fantastic group of people, and they give me feedback, and that made me sort of revise some things, change some things, and then working at putting the book through actually into publishing, as it were, with the Cuba Press, which is my publishing house. But I work with Paul Stewart, who was one of the editors on the book, and Maggie Rainey Smith, who's an Eastbourne writer and a friend, and she was the co-editor on it. So then they give me more stuff to think about and change, and it goes from there.
Mm. So I see Kristen Phillips is one of your writer group,
yes.
And she's ex from the Hutt Valley.
Yes, she
as
very
well.
Much is.
Korokoro, Hutt Valley High School, yes.
Absolutely.
We've had her on the show before.
Nice, yes, yeah. She's very good. She's a poet as well as a writer of, I guess, that creative nonfiction, which was Dad, You've Got Dementia, which you interviewed her about, yeah.
How have you sectioned the book?
Interesting you noted sections. I didn't exactly want to, but somehow they did fall into place. So the kind of the general poems at the front that to me are sort of setting the scene of me, so some stuff that's a little bit... Well, the first poem really is about the art of writing, the act of writing, how it happens. Something will happen, you grab hold of it, you might have a sense of, you know, some words to apply to that thing that occurs. In this case, it's a bee flying out from under my skirt when I'm reading in a field. And then it might be the rhythms that take you further with that, and then you start exploring an idea. So that's the first poem, and then the others sort of set the scene of me, some of them historically, some more recent. Yeah, just some that grab my attention in that way. And then we very much go to poems about Wellington, where I live now part of the week. I love living right in the central city here. I've found that shift from Eastbourne very interesting and stimulating. So there are Wellington City poems. They're very much Eastbourne poems. I lived there for 30 years of my life. It was a very important time to me.
When did you move to Eastbourne?
We moved there in 1988. And moved out, 2016.
Yeah. And what took you to Eastbourne in the first place?
Actually, my husband's parents were living out that way, and we kept going out and really were captivated by it. It felt beautiful, really, as a place to live, by the sea, away from the city. And it is. It's a beautiful place. So, yeah, we were there. And then the last section in the book is when we made the really traumatic decision to leave Eastbourne. We have a place in the Wairarapa where my husband grows olive trees, and that became the focus. So we left, and the last lot of poems are about that place, Martinborough. Mm.
Shall we go to the love story of the entomologist? And perhaps if you can give us a bit of a background to its writing, because I believe that's an Eastbourne one. Am I right
with
that?
Yeah, you really are right. And I love that you've asked me to read it, because I haven't read it before publicly or anything. And I don't know why. It just sat there as a poem about an entomologist. It's funny, isn't it? I really love it though, and it's a, it, yeah, it's the setting is the Muratai Park track. I used to walk it a lot with a friend of mine, Hilary. And one day there we were, and there was this man leaning in close to a tree and removing a rather large spider, and asked us to come and have a look at it, which we did. It stayed with me, the care and love he was showing towards this creature, and just that whole feeling when you're in the bush and it's all about nature and you're just a tiny part of that. Yeah. So is that enough background, do you think? I love that you picked it as an Eastman poem. Yeah. The love story of the entomologist. To find it, you need to feel the trunk with your fingers. It's soft, a lump, mossy, a door that you open with tweezers. You lean your cheek on the bark, scan the lump, insert the tweezers, tug. Your face so close, so tender, mouth as if to blow a kiss. It doesn't struggle. The many legs hang loose. You slide this into the tube you carry. It is yours now. It leaves threads of silk to catch the unwary, a soft, lumpish home, a trapdoor without hinge, where it was wary but not wary enough. It leaves behind the remains of the unwary. In the tube, it appears submissive, legless. You show me. Let me touch the mossy door. I wonder at it. When I walk that bush track now, I think always of your kissing mouth, your hands so clean, so cold, the love that you, spider by spider, tweezer out. I love those bushwalks, Eastbourne. They're really unmatchable, aren't they?
It's real feel of an autobiography in your writing there. And but that's what makes such an interesting read, you know, because it feels so real and relatable, and it's your life. Is there a desire to write an autobiography, or is this how you're sort of doing it by stealth?
It's really interesting. It sort of surprised me actually how many felt more like memoir. Yeah, you're right. I mean, poetry so often is personal. Not always, but so often is. Although poets often have that narrator, which is themselves, and then they'll twist things or change them a little bit for the sake of the poem, I guess, and also just because you can. But yes, I was surprised, and then I quite liked it. Mm-hmm. But I think that might be it. I mean, the thought of doing a whole memoir, God, frightens the hell out of me. It's a massive book. I mean, I do them, I publish them for other people, but there's so much that you've got to do in writing a memoir, or want to do, and that's write deeply about yourself and also the people around you. And I'm not sure the people around me want to get written about by me in that way, especially my family. So I think this will be it. Little glimpses, eh?
Now, mice seem quite popular. I thought if we could hear about singing mice as well. That's a fun one.
Yeah, you see, you don't know these themes are in your work, and then you put them together and go, there's a few mice in here.
There definitely is.
Quite a lot of little creatures, which I also found funny, but there we go, mice. I'm glad you like the mice. Singing mice. Okay, so this is definitely an Eastbourne poem. When we were living in Pukatea Street there, we had an incredible view of the sea, and it was such a lovely place to live. But of course, you know, you can see all that, but you've got your little domestic stuff going on, and the mice had invaded. So it was hard to deal with them. Singing mice. This is the week in which I find out that mice sing. Songs for courting, songs of pain. It's the same week things become unstuck at the office, and appliances and other things in the house stop working or work off kilter, like the heat pump that every now and again stops heating the room and lets out a deep sigh. One night, my brother arrives from Samoa with his family, and the lights go out in the kitchen, but the stove is okay. I cook by candlelight. We eat by candles too, which feels like fun, but only just. My brother laughs when I describe the extent of our dysfunctional house. His kids think it's funny too, until his daughter eats candle wax thinking it's something else and spits it into her lap. We discover the next day when the sparky comes that mice have chewed an electrical cable, which explains the power outage at least. He shows me the tooth marks, shakes his head at them. he's uncovered two bodies, hungry mice, singing mice, crisp and curled behind the dishwasher, scoops them up with a dustpan. "I'll take them," I say. He says, "Are you sure?" He's holding the dustpan close, a kind of shield. "Yes, I take it." The desiccated bodies, toothpick and fluff, shuffle softly as if waking. The Sparky makes a sound like a sigh, picks up a tool, goes back to the gnawed cable. I watch as he hunkers down beside the dishwasher, sprinkle of greying hair on the tops of his ears, blue overalls taut across shoulders as he leans, tool belt on hips, heavy with all that's useful. Then I go to dig a small hole under the aloes, tip the mice in, pat the soil. Back in the kitchen, he tells me over his shoulder that other women scream when he shows them dead mice. One fainted. I stare at the candles slumped in saucers. I suddenly need to call my brother before he leaves town. "I don't scream," I say, certain of this, "or faint." I pick at the wax. A single hardened drip makes the tiniest, most satisfying snap. "They say mice sing," I say at last. "Songs of courting, songs of pain." He swivels on one knee, pliers open. I have to say, Kristen Phillips really liked that one. She thought right. There was something quite sort of sensual about the old electrician, but we won't go into that. She sees a lot of those things in poems that aren't meant to be there.
Now, references to some of the past Eastbourne people. Do you want to give us maybe a bit of a sort of a... why you incorporated some of them? I think the first one we got was Colin Webster Watson.
Colin was a friend and a neighbour, lived in Pukatea Street right near us. We're very fond of Colin. What a character, what a larger-than-life person he was. He was a sculptor, he wrote poetry, he performed. He had a shop for a short time in Remu Street. He really made an impact in quite a short time. He didn't seem to be there all that long. He died, sadly. And we missed him. He used to feed the birds out on the waterfront every day, the seagulls. Who needs to feed seagulls? Colin thought he did. But yes, he was a friend of the family. He did so much locally. People adored him. And so I thought, I couldn't avoid writing about him. So, you know, when you're writing of place, to me, it's people too, always. I love the natural world, but I like the natural world with the creatures in it and with human beings in it. They fascinate me, you know. I love to see what makes them tick. And someone like Colin, you couldn't avoid him. Yeah, so he was one of the characters. There's a few artists in there. Annie Hayward appears three times, I didn't realise. And she, you know, I wrote one poem all about her doing a painting, The Fact of the Giant Cat. And she's also in that one. It's got a leaf, and that's about the wonderful Eastbourne fruit supply and the Lye family. And who can avoid them? And of course, now they're leaving Eastbourne. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. Well, their shop is closing next year.
Redevelopment.
Well, what a loss. You know, you live with those people there. They were a huge part of my daily existence, going out buying fruit from the Eastbourne Fruit Supply. Tom, Sandra, Richard. And of course, that poem's about them rushing around when they'd find a fruit with a leaf attached. They'd rush it around to Annie to paint because she's an artist. I just love that story. Yeah.
And then you got Alan Williams, the diplomat, was another one.
Mm. So was the husband, my friend Penny Walker, also a writer. Someone encouraged me a lot with my writing. And we used to go walking a lot together. And yes, Alan sadly died at the age of 50. Such a loss to his family and all his friends and people who knew him in the community. And loss as a diplomat too, an incredible man. And that really affected me, seeing what he went through. It felt too young. And the fact of his relationship with the South Island, that he could just see from up at the back of his place when he was hanging washing on the washing line, and how important it was to him. So that whole thing in Eastbourne of that view of that incredible, of the harbour and then the heads and then going out to the South Island, it's a big part of how you feel there.
Mm.
I wanted to capture what it was about him and his family and the loss we all felt, and for that writing that I use a sestina, which is a very defined form, but sometimes with poetry it's hard. You've got to find your place, and with big feelings that are billowing around, sometimes having a very tight form is really helpful.
When did you leave Eastbourne?
So 2016.
Yeah. And what was behind the leaving?
That was just that we had the house there, which we loved, but our kids had left home. The dog was getting old. This is relevant, but and we were getting older. And I think we felt the time had come to... We'd always had a property also in the Wairarapa. We were very lucky, you know, with olive trees. And we'd gone between the two, and that would be more our summer or holiday or weekend place. Right. But then my husband is devoted to those trees. And so we thought, yeah, we'll move over there and just make that our lives. But it's far from the sea, and it was quite hard to do. But we did it. And then we got the small place in the city because I was publishing, and it was really hard zooming back and forward between the Wairarapa and Wellington.
Mm. So I thought, could you read compost at this point, please?
Then? You're very good, John. You've read this so carefully. So that poem ends the Eastbourne section, because it was exactly as we were leaving, I looked at our compost and thought, oh my God, we're leaving all that behind. And of course the new owners had no idea. There was all our leftover food from how long sitting there rotting away nicely into compost. It's a strange feeling. Just love that whole thing about compost, that it's rotting stuff, but it's actually life-giving. You know, you're going to dig it into a garden one day and it goes round in the cycle, doesn't it?
Yep.
Grows vegetables to eat and on it goes, yeah.
And the hens are quite good at producing the air, but for the compost as well, high in nitrogen value.
Absolutely. I needed hens right there to add to that. That would have been good. Yep, so here we go. Compost. One heave and it falls from the bucket, clotted food into wormy tilth, the sharp stink of mould, stubs and skins and leaves and rinds and seeds, ripped, cut, chopped, left. I didn't think how it would be that this, just like the path, the aloes, the gate off its hinges, the moaning door, the light that polishes daily the length of our table, his height penned on the wall, the room of standing guitars, the mermaid, the room where my husband reads, the roof where I hang the washing, and the sight of my island would be theirs too. We'll be packed, left, and the black bin will greet them with a belly full of our excess, warm with rotting.
I'm John McDonald and you're in the Hut Zone on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. And that was the first part of my interview with local writer and publisher Miriam McCallum, sharing some of the poems from her latest book, Tackling the Hens. Part 2 airs next week. But sadly that means it's the end of this week's show. Thanks to all my guests tonight, and a big thank you to you for listening to the show and supporting Wellington Access Radio. You can always listen again to the show as a podcast on the Hut Zone pages of accessradio.org.nz. If you have a suggestion of a hut story or a piece of music or poetry, then please do message us either on Facebook, John McDonald NZ, or email the team. And our email is thehutzone@outlook.co.nz. Let's go out with some music from Tom Tom and the Groove Daddies, remembering that the drummer of this hut band was just 5 years old when it was recorded. Here's their cover of R.E.M.'s The One I Love. Mate wa e noro oru mai ra. Stay well.
This one goes out to the one I love. This one goes out to the one I love.
That program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks New Zealand On Air for funding accessmedia.nz.